We want to welcome in the warmest way a number of visitors we have in the assembly this morning. We hope you feel entirely at home. It's our intention that you should, and that you feel free to ask any questions that might be raised in your mind about what we are doing and what we're about here. In just a few moments, if you will turn to the second chapter of Joshua, we will continue the theme that's been set, however serendipitously, however coincidentally here this morning, as we talk about a theme out of the great book of Joshua. Because many of you have asked, I want to tell you that tonight our daughter and husband will fly to Cincinnati. Tomorrow she will enter the university hospital. And on Tuesday morning at 7:30, she will have her surgery. In this way, I feel very much with the Lockmillers, and I feel with the Shaws, who had a concern for their daughter, and I'm confident that all of us have read perhaps the story of Jairus and his interview with Jesus in Capernaum when he fell before him and pled for the life of his daughter. So we trust in the Lord and have confidence of the outcome. And we are reminded, as Paul said, that he who spared not his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not also freely with him give us all things? There is a story in Joshua that most people may have some familiarity with, but it's a rather startling story. And amidst all the carnage of the book, the slaughter of the Canaanite nations, about whom God had said to Abraham centuries before that the wickedness of the Amorites is not yet full. But when his people had spent 400 years in a strange land and been caused to suffer, in the fourth generation they would come out. And then this land, which had been occupied by this people, who for many centuries had increased in wickedness, would be delivered to the children of Israel. But the story of Rahab, amidst all that war, is in some ways like an oasis, but it's a rather startling kind of oasis. There are many lessons in the story of Rahab, but it especially teaches the universality, as broad as humankind, and the depth of God's mercy. And of course, gospel preachers have that as their theme. No matter what they may discuss, it is the intention of those of us who preach the goodness of God and His mercy in Jesus Christ to bring this point home to people who are at sea in their lives and apart from God because of sin. Let's begin this morning with her story as it's given in the book of Joshua, and I think probably in all likelihood written by Joshua himself. But we begin with the perspective of two young men who were sent to spy out the city of Jericho. Some have wondered why that was necessary, in view of the fact that God had already told Joshua, "I have given you the city." Why was it necessary to send spies there? I'm not altogether sure of the answer. God had said to the children of Israel, "I have given this land to you," and yet 12 spies were sent in by his instruction, ahead of the time. These two young men had to have considerable courage and strength because it was necessary in the spring of the year at the flood of the Jordan to swim the river. And then to secretly come into this fortress-like place that was shut up tightly against that horde of people who were poised, it appeared, to come into their land sitting on the other side of the Jordan in the plains of Moab. It was not a task for the faint-hearted. And so they came toward eventide. into the gates of the city still open. But the question we ask is, why would they go to the house of a prostitute? Because Rahab is not her complete name in the Old Testament. Not even in the New Testament, in most cases. Her name is Rahab the harlot. Somehow or another, we have in our minds tried to tone that down. But they went into a place of prostitution. Not for immoral purposes. But in all likelihood, because it was a good place to get lost and be unnoticed, because a lot of people would be going and coming who didn't care what anybody else was doing there and who had no intention of inquiring. All for their own purposes. And so they went, and what they received from Rahab was, first of all, shelter. And not just shelter from the crowd, but shelter from the king of Jericho, who had his spies at the gate, who had already reported that there were two men who had come into the city whose intention it was to spy out the land in preparation for the assault of their enemies. And he sent servants to knock on the door of Rahab. And she said, yes, they were here. And I didn't know what kind of men they were. You don't ask questions like that in a place like this. But they have gone. And if you'll hurry, you'll catch them as they're returning eastward toward the Jordan and back to their own camp. And so they left her door, and she hid these men on the roof of her house beneath some flax that was lying there to be bleached in the sun. And she also gave information to them that was significant. Joshua chapter 2 and verse 10. And I want you to read these words and appreciate how remarkable they are coming from the mouth of this woman. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the river, or dried up the water of the Red Sea before you, when you came up out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites that were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and to Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard it, our hearts did melt, neither did there remain any more spirit in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, He is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. As soon as we heard it, our hearts melted. These two young spies now understood the spirit of the city, the disposition of the city. They were in great concern and fear of this nearly 2 million people. 600,000 of whom nearly could be men of war, perhaps not all. And so there didn't remain in them any spirit of defense because of them. I want to observe, too, something about the faith of these two young men. Because when they are spoken to by Rahab about the disposition of the city and her own conviction, they said in verse 14 of the chapter, our life for yours, if you utter not this business, and it shall be when the Lord gives us the land that we will deal kindly and truly with you. Not if the Lord gives us the land, but when the Lord gives us the land. And yet, they had seen the walls of Jericho. It was a fortress that had never been taken in hundreds of years. And they recognized surely what kind of a force and what kind of bloodletting was going to have to occur as they perceived the situation from that point to take this city that they said God had given them. But to Rahab, they said, it's going to be given to us, and when it is, we will treat you with kindness. What a contrast to the spies at Kadesh Barnea, who having come back to report the goodness of the land, said, 10 of them. But the people there are like giants, and the walls of the city up to there, and before them we are like grasshoppers, and there is no way we can take this place. And so they disbelieved and wandered for 40 years, 38 years in the wilderness, till they died. True to the Lord, has delivered into our hands all the land, says Joshua 2, verse 24. For even all the inhabitants of the country do faint because of us, they reported to Joshua. Now, from Rahab's perspective, first of all, who she was. We need to just say that. Now, this is an awful kind of thing to consider, that this woman was selling herself to men who came to her. There is no way, either in Hebrew or Greek, to soften this word and to make it less than it means to us. The term harlot has been chosen, but the word for us is prostitute. And not just accommodatively someone who's loose in her morals, but someone who's in the business in this heathen city. She was a harlot in the heathen land. And any effort to gloss over that fact will cause us to lose the whole point, in many ways, of this story. What was her appeal to these spies, whom she had never met before? Chapter 2, verse 12 of Joshua. Now, therefore, I pray you, swear to me by the Lord, since I have showed you kindness, that you will also show kindness to my father's house and give me a true token, and that you will save alive my father and my mother and my brothers and my sisters and all that they have, and deliver our lives from death. And the men said to her, our life for yours, if you utter not this business. And then in chapter 2, verse 15, then she let them down by a cord through the window, for her house was upon the town wall, and she dwelt upon the wall. And she said to them, get you to the mountain, lest the pursuers meet you, and hide yourselves there 3 days, until the pursuers be returned, and afterward you may go your way. This is an event that took place within a very narrow period of time, 3 or 4 days, from the time that Joshua sends them forth and tells the people, after they are going to cross the Jordan in 3 days. And now Rahab says, you need to get up to the mountains west, because that's the opposite direction they'll think you have fled from here. And you stay there 3 days until they've given up the search, and then you'll be free to go. There's no mention by Rahab of husband or children or any of her family who lived with her, and how else could it be in a house of prostitution? I don't know what was felt by these ancient pagans in the city of Jericho about a woman who involved herself in such activity, perhaps not so strongly as we might, but still not a good place, even to heathen, even to the pagans. And so she pleads for herself and for her kindred. What she did is remarkable. She had not seen anything. What she had seen was the strength of Jericho, of which she was a racial part. She was an Amorite. She was a Canaanite. Her life had been spent, as was characteristic of this people, in extreme wickedness. Idolatry was corrupt, and it was so corrupt that God said, it's over, I've endured this as long as I can endure it, and I'm going to wipe these people out. It was an act of judgment. The armies of Israel that came into these lands, this was an act of divine judgment. And as God would later remind them, it wasn't because you were better than they were or bigger than they were. I did it because I promised Abraham that I would. But of course, at the same time, God acted in his righteousness to bring judgment upon these people. And amid
that kind of society, she believed. She heard and she believed. She didn't see. And I said that to impress upon you that if you're going to believe, it's going to be because you have heard, not because you've seen. For many of us, we're not going to make any radical changes in our lives until something so visible and so palpable and so tangible is present before us until it's absolutely undeniable. And I have to remind you this morning that nothing God ever did that was tangible and palpable and real in the presence of the eyes and ears of people ever was undeniable by them, because it has been done again and again. But if you and I ever come to believe in the true God, it'll be because we have heard and we have sense enough to recognize the impact of that. The book that we're studying from today is The Message. She had heard what had happened in Egypt. The word of that event had moved all across Canaan. And she had heard what had happened to the kings that were beyond the Jordan. And that had come. And her conclusion was that this people must worship a God who rules the world, who sits in heaven and has power throughout the earth. And so she declared. She had also come to know two Israelites, who, so far as Rahab was concerned, represented all Israelites. And they were men of confidence, and they were men of honor and goodness, as far as she could tell. But she believed because she had heard. She believed in a very hostile environment. She hadn't seen anything with her eyes that looked like Jericho would soon fall, and that the city would be taken. The city went on eating and drinking and working and marrying and giving in marriage, just like they always had. There wasn't any change in the routine. There was concern. She believed against all that her culture believed, with its horrible, polluted worship of corrupt deities and its immoral and ungodly ways. Was she a temple prostitute? I've wondered that. I don't know. No indication of it in this story. She believed in a God that was above all gods, a universal God. The Lord your God, she said, is in heaven above and earth beneath. You've got to understand how significant that is in a society where multiple gods were worshipped. All gods were limited to these people. They were gods of the hills or gods of the plain. They were gods of the harvest, or they were gods of war, or gods of love, and gods of fertility, and gods of the land, but they were never gods that covered everything. And what she has seen from what she has heard is that this is the true God. This is a real God who has nothing outside his control, whose power is absolute and infinite. And so she declares it. I understand that she is afraid, that fear has entered into her heart, and she recognizes what's about to happen. She believes what is about to happen on the basis of what she has heard. But I'll tell you something. Not a bad idea to be afraid. We teach our children to be afraid of the traffic in the street. We teach our children to be afraid of sharp objects. We teach our children to be afraid of things that are exceptionally hot. And if we are wise, we teach our children to be afraid of immoral activity and dishonest activity and dishonorable activity. And we so instruct them that they keep themselves away from that. It's good to be afraid. It's disastrous not to be afraid. And so she was afraid of a God like this, and recognized that if she was going to survive, and if her family was going to survive what was about to happen, it would be because she turned to that God and the opportunity presented itself. And she seized it up. In many ways, she was just like Abraham.
I'm not saying that Abraham was engaged in some business like Rahab's, but I'm simply saying that he was a man amidst the pagans and her the Chaldees, and that the gods his fathers worshipped were not the true God. And somehow, in some way, God came to him and said, leave this place and go to the place that I will show you. Leave your father's house. And Abraham believed God. And he had never seen the place to which he was to go. Didn't have a clue about what the journey would be like. Went out, as Hebrews 11 said, not knowing where he was going. And you think you know where you're going. You don't know where you're going. But you have the privilege of knowing who's guiding you. I say you don't know where you're going in the sense you don't know what's going to happen to you. What challenges will confront you? What difficulties? What heartaches or heartbreaks? But, though Abraham did not know that, he knew who was leading him, and he believed and trusted. And so also Rahab did not know what might take place in the days ahead, the rest of her life, but she knew this was God. And she had the wisdom to realize that you don't win in a war against God. And that everything you stack up here and everything that you experience here that happens to be pleasant for this moment will in no way compensate you for the absolute, ultimate, and utter loss that can come because you are fighting against God, which is the truth, which is reality, which at last is going to completely overwhelm. And so she chose, like Abraham, to believe in God. She also stood where the pagan Gentiles stood in the New Testament period when they first heard the gospel. Cornelius, when he first heard about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob down in this strange land where he was a part of an occupying force, 10th chapter of Acts. Or Sergius Paulus, who was the Roman governor of the island of Cyprus, heard Paul preach there and became a believer, and he'd been a pagan before. Or the Philippian jailer in the 16th chapter of Acts, who in the midst of his ordinary duties, when a man had been brought, two men had been brought to him to put into his prison, who had been beaten early in the day and accused of bad things by the people in the city, he had no idea until he's shaken out of his bed in the middle of the night by a great earthquake and goes in to try to see how his prisoners are doing and finds every door ajar and not a single prisoner absent. And the voice of Paul, when he's about to kill himself, do yourself no harm. We're all here. And he believed. And he was baptized. And he was a pagan. 1 Thessalonians 1, verses 9 to 11, Paul says, speaking of those Christians in the city of Thessalonica, that ancient Macedonian city where people came out of horrible paganism and idolatry to become followers of the true God, he said, I can't even tell your story because your faith to Godward has gone forth. They tell it before I can tell it. How you turned from idols to a living God to serve the true and living God and to wait for his Son from heaven. That was the story of people that she anticipates. Now, I want to speak about another thing for just a moment. And that is Rahab's salvation. The first thing we want to observe about it is conditional. Rahab wasn't delivered simply because she was there. Everybody that exists in the world that's in jeopardy because of sin, they're not delivered unconditionally. When she had this conversation with these men, verse 17 of Chapter 2 says, and the men said to her, we will be guiltless of this your oath, which you have made us to swear. Behold, when we come into the land, you shall bind this line of scarlet thread in the window, which you did let us down by, and you shall gather to you into the house your father and your mother and your brethren and all your father's household. And it shall be that whosoever shall go out of the doors of the house into the street, his blood shall be upon his head. And we shall be guiltless, and whosoever shall be with you in the house,
His blood shall be upon our head, if any hand be upon him. That scarlet rope. You'll notice that the scarlet rope about which the spies speak is the same rope by which he was about to let them down. And they said, you leave that there, so that the place of refuge will be marked, so that when this city is assaulted, no harm will come to you or anybody therein. Now that's the condition. It doesn't change the fact that this woman will be saved by the grace of God. Her immoral life, the fact that she's a part of a people who have been guilty of the most grievous kind of paganism, denying God, refusing to acknowledge the glory of the true God. When she is redeemed, when she is saved from this awful destruction of this city, it will be grace that does it. But it's conditional. I say that because we have so many people who feel as though somehow or another this loving God is just going to sweep away all considerations of what we have done and not done and all the issues of our lives, whether we have tried at all to know him or to do his will or had any concern whatsoever about that, that somehow or other he'll sweep all that away and that'll be no concern to him at last when life comes to the final day of divine judgment. And I want to tell you that nothing we read in Scripture says that, intimates it, suggests it in the slightest possible way. Condition was this salvation of hers, the scarlet cord. I think we can see Rahab immediately. These men are let down out of the window, putting that rope there and securing it, and then going urgently to her father and to her mother and to her brothers and sisters and to her father's family and saying, come to my house, because disaster is going to come to this city. I'm amazed they came. I don't know if they looked on her as a prodigal. Chances are they may not have. But why should they listen to this woman tell them that these people who are on the other side of the Jordan, which is in the flood stage, are going to walk over here and going to tear the walls of this city down and come in here and destroy us unless we stay in that room where that scarlet rope is? There's something incredible about that. But there was something, something in the earnestness of this woman. She had credibility of some sort. And she urged them, and they came and were inside those walls when Joshua and the armies of Israel marched round it seven times. And they were delivered, says the sixth chapter. I cannot imagine, may I say, in passing as an aside, anyone who knows the way of salvation not having the same kind of urgency in his treatment of all he loves and cares about. Come and be saved. And let me add this, though there's no biblical basis for it, but from the time of about 98 A.D. when Clement of Rome wrote his letter to the church at Corinth. This is not a part of the text of Scripture, and it's not inspired literature. But from that point onward, that scarlet robe in the story of Rahab has symbolized for teachers and preachers the blood of Christ. The Bible nowhere makes that association. But I'll tell you one in this story that does, because before these people assaulted the city of Jericho, they ate the Passover. And in the Passover, a lamb was slain, cooked and eaten. And the blood of that lamb was put, as it was originally, upon the doorposts and lintels of the houses. Not now, but then. And God said, when I see the blood, I will pass over you. And the wrath of God fell upon the people of Egypt, and the firstborn of every man and beast died that night where there was no blood. But the blood was a shelter, and the blood was a refuge. Even as this room with this scarlet rope was a refuge for people from their just deserts. These people are not escaping because they're good people, not like the rest of the ungodly people in Jericho. These are the good people, the fine people, the wonderful people. That's not true. They're going to be saved simply because they trusted
and believed in God and in His willingness to spare them. But there's not only the scarlet cord. I want to speak to you as the New Testament speaks about the faith she had. This is not the faith of the mouth. This is the faith that takes the risks, that knows she's fighting against the king of Jericho, the king, when she lies to his ministers who come. And she knows very well that if she is found out, if this lie is exposed, that she is a dead woman, you think you'd spare some prostitute? She would have no hope. She identifies with this God and with these people while she's still in the city of Jericho and still in grave danger. Now, this is an act of faith because it is a faith that risks death. Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 31. We are a bit startled, I think, to see recorded in this chapter, which is sometimes called Faith's Hall of Fame, that begins all the way back with the case of Abel and again, by faith, by faith, by faith. Victories were achieved. Lives were lived triumphantly. But amidst all this, when great names are mentioned like Abel and Noah and Abraham and Sarah and Moses, suddenly, by faith, Rahab the harlot perished not with them that were disobedient, having received the spies with peace. Perished not with them who were disobedient. There is a faith that is shallow and doesn't get past the mouth, which is disobedient. And that won't do the job. The faith of this woman had teeth in it. And the reason I know that is because of James. Not James merely, but James, the second chapter, puts her in some remarkable company. James 2, verse 21. Was not Abraham our father justified by works in that he offered up Isaac his son upon the altar? That's faith. Abraham taking his son, his only son by Sarah, the son of promise, the son by which he's to become the father of a great nation. All the promises are to be fulfilled through this one child, Isaac. He's a young man, able to carry a load of wood. And he, with that son, leaving all others behind, goes up the side of Mount Moriah. And there the son says to him, Father, here's the wood and here's the fire, but where is the sacrifice? And Abraham, in utter faith, declares to him, My son, the Lord will provide for himself a sacrifice. And he did. But Abraham, so far as he was concerned, as we are told, had already sacrificed the boy in accordance with the Lord's command. Take your son Isaac and offer him as a burnt offering on the mountains of Moriah. That's faith. Don't talk to me about a word spoken. It is not a mere confession. It is a confession that has about it the deep commitment of the heart and a change of will. That's what faith is. It means your way is my way and your truth is my truth from this point on. And so as Abraham risked the life of his son, so Rahab the harlot risked her life. And another truth about this is it was a lasting kind of faith. Joshua chapter 6, verse 25, when the city has fallen. And all the conquest is complete. A statement is made about her, and here again I say it was penned by Joshua himself. But Rahab the harlot and her father's household and all that she had did Joshua save alive, and she dwelt in the midst of Israel to this day because she hid the messengers whom the Lord sent to spy out Jericho. She took her place with the nation of Israel. She was not a pagan anymore.
And she wasn't a harlot anymore. Even though her name is not simply Rahab again, but Rahab the harlot. But there's more to the story than that. She married and bore a son. And if the things that we have seen so far have startled us a bit, look with me at the first chapter of Matthew, the chapter about which some have said is more read than any other chapter in the New Testament because people started and give up and quit. But here is the genealogy of Jesus. Look at verse 4. And Ram begat Amminadab, and Amminadab begat Nashon, and Nashon begat Salmon, and Salmon begat Boaz of Rahab. Now, listen, in most cases here, the wife is unmentioned. But this says that Salmon begat Boaz of Rahab, and Boaz begat Obed of Ruth. Ruth was a Moabite, the widow of a Jewish woman's son, to whom she said, wherever you lodge, I'm going to lodge, and your people be my people, and your God my God. So Ruth said to Naomi. And so she went into that strange land and married Boaz, and she was the great-grandmother of David. But that's not so much a scandal as Rahab, the harlot. It lasted as long as she lived. Her father-in-law was the head of the tribe of Judah when Moses constructed the tabernacle at Mount Sinai. Read the 7th chapter of Numbers. Now, to close the lesson, I want to talk about the example that this remarkable woman set. I should pause to observe that in the genealogy of Jesus, it does not say Rahab the harlot. And somebody said, well, maybe it's another Rahab. Well, that's possible, but why? Why this note? Why put this name in here if it doesn't have anything to do with the one Rahab we know of? And why put this Ruth in there if it doesn't have anything to do with the one Ruth we know about? The question that really is raised at the beginning, is she a suitable person for us to be following? Should she have been placed in the actual lineage of the Messiah? Listen to me, my friend. Every person in the family tree of the Messiah was a sinner who needed to be saved by the blood of the one who would at last be born through the line. Every last one of them. No exception. And so far as Rahab the harlot was concerned, she was in no greater need of the blood of Christ than any one of them. And so the question is really raised, how do we differ from her?
Well, I tell you, I've never been involved in such untoward activity as she was.
I know that's socially reprehensible, and it's awful. And it must take a remarkable God with remarkable power to take a woman like that with her background. And I presume she was rather young. And turn her into a woman of righteousness and chastity, and make her the mother of one who would at last be the line by which the Christ would come into the world. It must take a remarkable God with remarkable mercy and with remarkable power that causes a person like that not simply to say, yes, I believe that you are the God of heaven and you rule on earth, but the one who said it and meant it and lived it. That's the true God. And we don't differ from her in that we too
unless we come into a relationship with Him by faith and stay in the place of redemption and salvation, we are going to face God unprepared and unready. And won't that be a tragedy? We all deserve the fiery judgment of God because of our sin. We have not lived up to it. We just keep on thinking, I haven't done anything quite that bad. Wouldn't you have sinned against God and lived your life without thought of Him? Listen, that's bad. I don't think it can get worse than when we deny effectively the existence of God and that He's to have no control in our lives. We're to have the control. That's the wickedness of rebellion and sin. Whether we do what she did, or whether we do something else that's equally contrary to the will of the great God. So we have to face up to that. Not very pleasant. But it is the point from which we come to know God's goodness and mercy and a different kind of life than we have lived. Now, the real question is, we can look at Rahab and think, oh, that's a bad woman. And yet some of us not as smart as she was. We're not as wise as she was. We're not as courageous as she was. She went against everything with which she lived. All her background. All her people. The city in which she had residence. Everything cried out against the decision that she made, but she made it because she willed out of her understanding that it had to be so. And she was willing to put herself in jeopardy in order to declare that she believed that Jehovah was God. And God cared for her and all that were in her house. Where are you today? Have you come to the place where the blood of Christ flows by faith that is real? You're not going to be called upon this morning to let some men down over a window and attach a scarlet rope to the sill. You're not going to be called upon to take your child, your only son, and carry him to some mountain and offer him as a burnt offering. But you are going to be called upon to give your life. As Jesus said, if you would come after me, deny yourself and take up your cross and follow me. But the initial affirmation of faith and the means by which God, the condition by which God brings mercy to your soul and cleanses you of every sin, is as Jesus said, he that believes and is baptized shall be saved. I didn't say that. The Lord said that. It was not the scarlet rope that saved Rahab. It was God. And it's not baptism that cleanses us from our sin, but it's God who cleanses us from our sin when our faith responds by obedience. And then afterward, the commitment we make when we die with Him and are raised again to walk in newness of life, as Paul describes in Romans 6, 3 and 4, continues to guide and rule our lives, and it ought to last a lifetime. I read a story from the recent issue of the Russian Update about a Russian brother in Nizhny Novgorod. Charlie Gant was reporting. He said, we had a really distressing day and one of great joy. And it all came the same day. He came to them and said his mother was after him, continued to go ahead and live like a husband with his girlfriend and have children. Only trouble was she's married somebody else. And did he ought to go out and enjoy himself? He said, I'm just under constant pressure. Charlie said, we invite him to stay with us for a few days. Get away from that. And so he did. And afterward, he came to them one day with his Bible and all his study material. He said, I don't want to be a Christian anymore. Take my Bible, take everything. I can't stand this pressure. I'm just going to go back and be like I was before. And they said they were crushed. 3 days later, he showed up at a worship assembly where 15 or 20 people come together in Nizhny Novgorod with one or two friends. And he said, when I went back and said to my wife, or to my girlfriend, I'm going to be with you. She said, that's not enough. You're going to have to really get back to living the free life we had before and drinking with your buddies and doing all those things. He said, how could a man who had come to know a better life go back to what was worse than he knew before? He said, I can't do that. As far as I know, his faith is living still. You'll be tested. But God is still God. And faith is still the answer to life's fundamental needs. And we invite you to believe in the same God Rahab trusted her soul to the one who sent his son into the world to die in your stead, that you might have life and have it more abundantly. Put some teeth in your faith and act upon it and live by it, because God will not desert you, though all other things will. If you'd like to be a Christian this morning, when we stand and sing this invitation hymn, you just come down the aisle and take your place here on the front seat, and we'll give you the opportunity to make the confession that you can read about in the New Testament, that you believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. You will confess Jesus as Lord, as Romans 10, verse 9 speaks of. And then you will, as they were, be immediately baptized into Christ, buried in the water as he was buried in the earth, raised up by the grace of God, freed from your transgressions and sins, to walk a new life, as the Scripture says, while we're standing together and singing.